All right. I want to go back to the, we saw last time the, Paul's, basic assumption that with the arrival of Jesus that a few things happened. Number one, that the old, what's called the old dispensation, the old dispensation, which, people could be saved, they could guarantee their place in Olam Haba, they could guarantee their relationship with God, could be affected by keeping mitzvot, okay? That old dispensation was over. From now on, the only way for people to be able to be saved simply means to have a place in Olam Haba. It's really synonymous. Yesh lo chelek l'Olam Haba means to be saved. Because the alternative is what? Hell, right? However that looks. I don't know, this reminds me of what's his name? No, who's the guy with the Reverend, what's his name? From New York. The guy with the long hair. He used to be fat, now he's thin. Sharpton. See, he once came to Israel, and he came to Israel, and there was no cabs, he couldn't get anywhere, whatever. After 24 hours, he went home, and people said, one guy said, go to hell. He says, I am in hell, I'm in Israel. Turned out he expected to do stuff, and he arrived Erev Yom Kippur. And no cabs, no nothing. So
he didn't know.
No, and he had no idea. So, anyways. With Jesus' suffering, which is the only way to appropriating his suffering for you, that's the only way to be saved. So therefore, the old dispensation is now gone. But that has a lot of ramifications. Ramification number one means that the entire Torah, on the one hand, now no longer is operative. That doesn't mean God made a mistake. It means that I mentioned that Jesus' messiahship is spiritual, and it's only aimed at the soul. So similarly, we only need the spiritual meaning of the words, not the physical meaning of the words anymore. Number one. Number two, that means that all of the good things in the Bible refer to those who believe in Jesus. All the bad things refer to those who reject Jesus, which means that all the descriptions of the bad things in the Bible only refer to Jews, because they're the ultimate protester. And we'll come back to that. Number three, that also means that it raises the question of, what is the role of the Jew henceforth. We talked about Augustine. We're going to backtrack a little bit, because I want to read a couple of passages from Justin Martyr in that connection. One of the things which is going to consistently is going to consistently preoccupy Christians, is going to be Christian thinkers, is why, what did the Jews do? Who are they? Why did they reject the truth? They knew the truth. They met Jesus. They knew all this. How come? It's going to be a major issue in terms of developing the position on who the Jew is. And here I want to make a distinction, that's a final sort of summary, that they're in from the time of Augustine, actually before that, onward, there's a fundamental difference between two Jews. There's the Jew who lives next door to you, b'midah that there were Jews there, and there's the theological Jew, the real Jew, the guy who is the guy who's hiding behind the facade. Who is that person? In general, church cultivated among Christians the idea that despite the fact that the Jew you see may look a certain way, in reality he reflects this ultimate Jew who rejected Jesus, who whatever is wrong with him, or whatever is right with him, is really there. The truth of the matter is so later on, we'll talk about this again, not today but next week, as the image of the Jew in Christian thought becomes more and more diabolical, okay, this becomes more pungent, and ultimately leads to the old myth that Jews have what?
Horns
and hoofs and tails. Now, I heard from a number of World War II veterans, and this is a story that keeps flowing around, of Jews from New York, California, whatever, when they were drafted into the army in World War II, and they would go for basic training, they would meet people from Iowa, from flyover America, from the people who actually put Trump into office. Right? Nebraska, wherever it is. And, you know, it's group showers. So you go to the shower, boom, and honestly and innocently, they would ask the Jewish guy, where are your hoofs and your horns and your tail? So, I mean, okay, so you heard the story, okay? So I'm going to tell you yesterday. Okay, so I will tell you yesterday. So I have a question. I have a story from yesterday, from 2016. I told the story because it happens to be I came to a unit about this. I'm teaching a course at Bar-Ilan this year about the war against the Talmud and its effect on Judaism and on because you know that the Talmud was burned constantly over the course from 1240 on, 1242 on. So as part of the introduction, we're talking Dafka about this, and a student of mine raised her hand. She's like turned white. I said, well, are you okay? She said, no. It's just like, yes, but as growing up in Uruguay, as a little girl, she remembers that they had a maid who worked for them, and they started working, and and Friday night when they went to light candles, explained to the Ozeret what with the candles, and she went blank, and she said, you're Jews? Where are the horns? Where are the tails? Where are the hoops? She woman had been working in the house. Okay? So, you know, so you put the two together, you must hide them, you must be there, but they're there. Or if they're not there, physically, they're there, you know, sort of, conceptually. But that's gonna be further along than where we are. Let's take a look. What I wanna do now is to sort of fill in some of the things I missed yesterday. So number one, the question of whether Judaism was going to belief in Nascent Christianity was going to continue to be a Jewish sect or not was a matter of debate, of serious debate between what was called the primitive church and Paul. Paul's position, I told you, that's the one that won out, that, you know, that no more, now we're starting something new, and the original followers of Jesus, including his brother, or his cousin, the Catholics don't think he had any brothers, so his cousin, probably his brother, James the Just, who was the head of the group of the Hasidim in Jerusalem, said, no, Jesus is going to be the Messiah, he's going to come back, he's going to redeem Israel. And Paul comes back and said, no, there's no more Israel. Israel's now anybody who believes in Jesus, period. And this was a major issue. It came down to what was called the debate over circumcision. Why circumcision? Because both sides said that a person wants to convert has to go to a mikveh, has to be baptized. Baptism now in the larger churches is something more formal. They spritz a little water on you, but it used to be you went to the Jordan, you went to a mikveh, and goodbye. So, unless you're a Baptist. So the point is that at that point, there was no question about that a non-Jew who wanted to become a Christian had to be baptized. Question is circumcision because that was Brit Avraham, and also because it was going to be totally, you know, I mean, well, you know, there's a whole intact movement that's sweeping that's way from the United States, because of course it's rooted in Boston. What are we going to do? And in Europe there are, it's considered to be a form of castration. It's constantly being attacked as child abuse. In the Roman world, which worshipped the perfect human form, I mean, there was nothing more horrible. It's one of the great ironies. If you've been to the Accademia degli Arti in Florence, I mean, you know, David Melech has an orla. It's one of these weird, you know, nobody told Michelangelo that, excuse me, sir, that doesn't work that way. In any event, in fact, one of the odder things, I don't know if you remember, I used to get these as a kid. My parents used to get these, elders on around the end of December for the following year, and they always had all the holidays. Now they have Muslim holidays too. So the holiday, if you look at these things, so on the 1st of January, it always said New Year's, and then circumcision. And I'm sitting thinking, what the hell is that? What is that? I mean, what, I have to go do it again? I mean, I've been there, done that. What's the joke about you couldn't walk or talk for a year? So, Circumcision basically is a celebration of Jesus' circumcision. How do you know it's January 1st? It's very simple. If he was born on January, on December 25th, the 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 1. No. So, and in the Catholic Church to this day, they celebrate they have a special mass on the festival of circumcision. The truth of the matter, Jesus wasn't born Bechlal he wasn't born in December. He was born in the summer. Nobody in this group has to be convinced of that, for the simple reason that the scene of Jesus' birth describes shepherds in the hills of Bethlehem hanging out in the middle of the night. No self-respecting shepherd in our neighborhood, hangs around Stam in the middle of the night, like towards dawn, just because he wants to be outside in the summer, maybe. Basically, December 25th is a Roman holiday called Saturnalia, and it was co-opted by the Christians as Jesus' birth date, for obvious reasons, because Jesus' life and birth are not that important to Christianity. His death is what the most important holiday in Christendom is. Easter. Not Christmas. So everyone knows it's a difference when we're going to observe his birth. So we'll Christianize the same way, by the way, that all kinds of pagan sites were Christianized in Europe. Look at what's one of the frumest early German tribesmen used to worship forests. If you read Beowulf as a kid in college, it's always the forest. You can take the forest, you can chop down the forest. It's a very big deal in terms of civilization and so on and so forth. Okay, what is the name of one of the frumier neighborhoods north of London?
Golders Green.
And?
Stamford Hill.
St. John's Wood.
Oh, St. John's.
The wood that maybe belonged to Frigga or Woden or Thor became St. John's Wood. So we were MacGyver the wood, and that's resolved.
You said something about this thing about the circumcision on the calendar. If we're getting away from Judaism and we're abandoning, why are we celebrating that? You think they downplay it?
It's an excellent question. The answer is that it's a very strange thing.
All of them do it.
The Christianity has a very has a built-in Jewish problem. Has a built-in Jewish problem. As much as they try to, we looked at some of these passages last week, as much as Paul tried to get away from all of it, nevertheless, it remains true that Jesus himself, and that's clear from the Gospels, led a more or less Jewish life. And so the question is, how do you do that? And in fact, much of Christian interpretation of the Bible is devoted to proving to themselves and to others why this no longer applies. That's Paul, actually, in his letters, does a lot of that as well. One of the interesting, I actually got to say this on TV a couple of weeks ago when I talked about the UNESCO thing on Rich Stein. One of the odder things is, you know, if Jesus' death was supposed to undo all the mitzvahs, one of the strange things is that in one of the earlier chapters, chapter 1 and chapter 2, of the book of Acts, it's described how some of the apostles went up to the Har HaBayit to catch mincha. Because they had the afternoon prayers.
The Pesach Seder.
Right, Beseda. Okay, but he wasn't dead yet. Fine. But this is a few weeks later. And they say they happen to be walking by. So, no, we'll go to the Shtimalach and we'll catch Mincha at Har HaBayit. I mean, so nobody told them either that this great transformation. In any event. So the question be, this debate over circumcision came.
Jesus hadn't died for people's sins yet, so then what's the stirrup?
What? No, he's dead. No, this story about Mincha, that's true with regard to the Pesach Seder. It's not true with regard to, Bimidah that it was a Pesach Seder, because there's a machlokus as to whether he was killed Erev Pesach or not, or in Pesach itself, and that would actually determine it, because he was obviously the Last Supper was the night before, so. In any event, so this debate about whether you have to have some kind of connection with the law or not to be saved, it becomes an issue. So initially they said, the Jerusalem church, the original followers of Jesus say, no, you have to become a Jew. That's what circumcision means in that regard. You have to be circumcised and go to mikvah, meaning you've got to convert. This fight continued quite some time and came to a resolution. That's text number 1. Therefore, I have reached the decision that we should not trouble these Gentiles who are turning to God, but we should write to them to abstain only from things polluted by idols, and from fornication, and from whatever has been strangled, and from blood. For in every city for generations past, Moses had had those who proclaimed him, for he has been read aloud every Sabbath in the synagogues. Most scholars, if you take a look at what they've been told to avoid, things polluted by idols, in other words, idolatry. Fornication would mean incest or some sort of sexual impropriety. Whatever had been strangled and from blood. Strangled would appear to be some kind of cruelty to animals type of thing. If you add to that the fact that you're supposed to not worship idols, generally, many scholars think that basically the compromise was that these people can be, that non-Jews who want to join the Christian faith can have to accept the Shavuot Mitzvot B'nei Noach. That's what's hinted at here. But they have to. The compromise was that they have to be kabbal mitzvahs, but they should become gerim toshavim. They put it in halachic parlance, because by accepting Shavuot Mitzvot B'nei Noach, then you become a ger toshav, then you have a chaylik l'olam haba and shalom al Yisrael. At the end, it didn't matter because what was going on in Jerusalem wasn't what took off. I just read actually an estimate that there were never any more than a few thousand Jewish Christians in Israel, but it, you know, Christianity took off because it was basically Judaism light in a Hellenistic mode, and that was what and that's what spread. So that's number one. Number two, around in the 140s, approximately 150s, Justin Martyr, who was from Shechem, actually from Neapolis. Nablus, that's why Nablus is called Nablus. It's Shechem. Why is it Nablus? Because it was part of one of the 10 Hellenistic cities that were built in Israel in the second century, from the second century on, known as the new city, Neapolis. But the Arabs don't say a P. So Neapolis became constricted to Nablus. Exactly. Or Palestinian. Justin Martyr was a major, one of the, what's called the Church Fathers. And he had an exchange, he had a long exchange in which he laid out his theological beliefs with a guy named Trypho, who was a Jew. There are those who argue that this Trypho was in fact none other than Rabbi Tarfon. Now, whether the book itself, which is very, very long, as you can see, I've quoted from chapters 123 and 136, there's a lot before, obviously, and there's a lot after, whether this is actually an actual recounting of the exchange or reflects exchanges that he had doesn't matter. It says after married Bar Kokhba, he mentions, in fact, in the book how the Jews persecuted Christians because they wouldn't join Bar Kokhba and the revolt against Rome. But the Christians couldn't join Bar Kokhba. Why?
They thought Bar Kokhba was the Messiah.
Exactly, because Bar Kokhba deemed himself to be Messiah, as did Rabbi Akiva, and they already had a Messiah, so they were But it shows you two things. First, the intensity of the messianic element in the Meribah Bar Kokhba. And B, it teaches you something about the fact that the Jews and Christians were at least still talking. We're going to see that reflected in Chazal as well. So that's going to speak to the question of when did the two groups separate. But I just wanted you to see these two paragraphs, which sort of adumbrate what we said before leading up to Augustine. Since then God blesses this people and calls them Israel and declares them to be his inheritance, meaning us at that point, how is it that you repent not of the deception you practice on yourselves as if you were alone were Israel and of execrating the people whom God has blessed? For when he speaks to Jerusalem and its environs, he thus added, and I will beget men among you, even my people Israel, and they shall inherit you, and you shall be possession for them, and you shall no longer be bereaved of them. Says Trypho in total shock, you're Israel? You now have the keys to, you're it? You're Israel? You're taking away our very identity? Answer, yes. And he speaks such things of you? Says Justin Martyr, if indeed we had not entered into long discussion on these topics, I might have doubted whether you asked this question in ignorance. But since we have brought this matter to a conclusion by demonstration with your assent, I do not believe you are ignorant of what I have just said, or desire again mere contention, but that you are urging me to exhibit some same proof to these men. In other words, ein hachinami. I'm surprised you asked the question. I've just spent 122 paragraphs proving to you that you are now history, and we are the future. We are now Verus Israel, the true Israel. By the way, in your travels through the United States, you will find churches, the Shiloh Baptist Church. You will find the Palestine Baptist Church. You will find the United Baptist Hebrew Congregation. Why Hebrew? Because in classical Christian code, Hebrews are biblical figures who anticipate the coming of Jesus, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on. Jews are the people who rejected him. You will find Israel. All these things are part of something called supersessionism. They are us and we are nothing. Okay?
Which is also, I mean, I missed last week, but it's also proven by the defeat of the Jewish people.
Right, Nachinami. They will all, the question of the significance of exile, correct. Correct.
Yeah.
The significance of the exile and the dispersion as a theological proof is very, it's constant. It's constant. God
is used to too.
Correct.
Your God isn't saving you.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. Which raises Jews have this entire, have developed this entire counter theology. I mean, look, we're very good at this. I think more cynical. Arguments as to why is it spread throughout the world that the Christians sort of like after a century or so sort of like disappeared and became Muslims and the Jews didn't, because we have a whole, you know, we know how to do this. We've got an entire guilt responsibility kind of theology. We know how to deal with this. The Christians were winners up until that. They had no idea. So at that point their defeats actually, you know, they undermined their whatever. Okay, that's chapter 123. Chapter 136. Just to give you a sense of how extremist gets. For you see how he now addresses the people, saying a little before, as the grape shall be found in the cluster, they shall say, as the grape should be found in the cluster, destroy it not, for a blessing is in it, so will I do for my servant's sake, for his sake I will not destroy them all. This prefigures Augustine. And thereafter he adds, and I shall bring forth the seed of Judah and out of Jacob and out of Judah. It is plain now that if he thus be angry with them and threaten to leave very few of them, he promises to bring forth certain others who shall dwell in his mountain. But these are the persons whom he said he would sow and beget. In other words, the non-Jews are going to join. For you neither suffer him when you... In other words, he says, some of you are going to be saved.
Yeah.
But, obviously he needs a people, so he'll bring in the non-Jews who are now going to become part of the real Israel to take your place. For you neither suffer him when he calls you, nor you hear him when he speaks to you, but you have done evil in the presence of the Lord. But the highest pitch of your wickedness lies in this, that you hate the righteous one and slew him. And so treat those who have received from him all that they are and who are pious and righteous and humane. Therefore, woe unto their soul, says the Lord. For they have devised an evil counsel against themselves, saying, let us take away the righteous, for he is distasteful for us, to us. For indeed you are not in the habit of sacrificing to Baal, as were your fathers, or placing cakes and groves in the high places for the host of heaven, but you have not accepted God's Christ, which is the same difference. In other words, the Avodah Zarah that the Jews in Bayit Rishon did, one of the funnier things that happens is they found in a number of places in Lachish and elsewhere, they found clearly Jewish settlements where there were little sanctuaries for idolatry. So Haaretz came out with a big, huge top headline, the Jews really worship idols. So my son pointed out, hello? Have you read the Bible lately? I mean, what are you talking about? Yeah, but oh, look at this. So anyways, for he who knows not him knows not the will of God, and he who insults and hates him that sent him, and whoever believes not in him believes not the declarations of the prophets who preached and proclaimed him to all. You don't get it. You rejected. You are toast. Now, as I mentioned, that raises the question of, so, who are these Jews, and why did they act that way? So, as I mentioned, just give me one second.
So, could it be that there's a world where, like, okay, you want to believe that, good. We don't have to destroy the Jews because we have this other, you know, that doesn't work, right?
Mm-mm.
No. Okay. Just checking.
That, unfortunately, does not work.
Yeah. We live in the world of relativity, like you believe what you believe in.
Correct.
That wasn't correct. That's more of a Jewish idea than it is a Christian idea.
So what ends up happening... Oh, I have to change this. So what ends up happening is... unfortunately, I can't do this by remote. Oh, she's going to kill me. I didn't start it. Oh, I did. Okay, good. What ends up happening is this, that in order to be able to... I mean, I've thrown out a lot of stuff here. In order to make Seder in all of these points, And in order to, we have, they're providing us with our own, we don't have to use our own ink. There's a lot, in order to ground and make Seder in all of these. Yeah.
Okay, so this thing from Justin Martyr.
Yeah.
At this time, was Jesus considered, Justin Messiah, was he also?
No, but Paul already sees him as God.
Okay.
You know what? Before we get to typology, I should add one extra thing. How did Jesus go from being the Messiah to being the Son of God? Or being God incarnate? So there are a number of ways to look at it. I think one of the best ways to understand it actually was proposed, at the time by, Gershom Scholem. Gershom Scholem was struck by, not by so much by Christianity, but by a similar phenomenon some 1600 years later. In 1648, a Jew who apparently was bipolar, but brilliant, good looking too, from Izmir in Turkey, declared himself to be a Messiah. His name was Shabtai Tzvi. For reasons which are really, not for us to go into right now, the expectation and the hopes that he would be the Mashiach spread throughout the entire world. All the way from Hamburg in Germany, if you've read the diaries of Glickel of Hameln, she writes how her father sold his business and sat on suitcases waiting for the word to go to Israel because Shabtai Tzvi is going to redeem the Jews. In Yemen, there were people waiting for him to come. It was like it reached a fever pitch to the degree that even the non-Jews noticed this. A friend of mine, once gave me, unfortunately I lost it, a broadside. One of the reasons why, for example, are newspapers in London on Fleet Street? Fleet Street, that's the area where all the newspapers used to be. Because the major source of international news was the ships that would come into London Harbor. So the ships would dock, and the reporters would go and ask the sailors what's going on, and then they would publish broadsides with the news from whatever. So in this broadside that a friend of mine gave me a Xerox of from 1666, the paper reports that the Jews in all the world are going crazy. They're dancing in the streets. They think the Messiah is coming. They're out of their minds. In 1666, he goes to, which is also, by the way, expected to be the year of Jesus' return among Christians. 666 is a sign of the Antichrist. There was going to be whatever. He went to the Turkish Sultan and invited him to convert to Judaism because he's the Messiah. The Turkish Sultan instead had him arrested and gave him the choice of losing his head or putting a turban on it. He chose to put a turban on it and convert to Islam. Scholem then noticed that there's no room in Judaism for a Messiah who becomes an apostate, just like there's no room in Judaism for a Messiah who dies, certainly not one before he fulfills his messianic mission. So how does that work? So Scholem saw the similarity to the two phenomena, Sabbatianism and Christianity, where people couldn't give it up. Like, what happened here? He caused that parallel. Most historians today connect the dynamic which allowed for the continuation of Judaism, Christianity, and Sabbatianism. By the way, Sabbatianism exists to this day. There are people in Turkey called the Dunme. The Dunme were the secret the Jews who followed Shabtai Tzvi into Islam, on the idea that they were going to redeem the Nitzotzota Elokiyot from the Klipot, from within the world of Tumah, and they're still there. And they're still waiting. They're still Sabbatians, okay? And in fact, the Muslims know that they're not really good Muslims, that they're really Jews undercover. And in fact, it's a good thing you're sitting. If I tell you that many serious members of the Young Turks movement, including a person named Kemal Atatürk, were members or descendants of the Dunme. Tansu Çiller, who used to be the foreign minister and prime minister of Turkey, who he was here a couple of times on visit, and made a big point of, you know, praying in Al-Aqsa, is also from the Dunme. So if you want to argue that secular Turkey is a Jewish conspiracy, there would be good reason to make that point. In any event, the question is, what leads to this kind of counterintuitive kind of behavior? So in the 1950s, there was Jewish psychologist, well, that sort of repeats itself, right? There was a psychologist whose name was, I forget his name. Quick. Boy, this is a senior moment. This is embarrassing.
Yeah,
I'll think of it in a minute. He wrote, a guy who wrote his book called, When Prophecy Failed. He followed a UFO cult in northern New York, where a woman said she had a visitation from an extraterrestrial who told her that there's going to be a great disaster and the world is going to be destroyed. But he's going to send a spaceship for her and all of the people that believed and take them to safety and then bring them back or whatever was going to happen. So the day that was set for the arrival of the UFO to get them, or the spaceship to get them off planet Earth before the disaster, she and all of her followers are sitting in their living room, and guess what happened? Or guess what didn't happen? What didn't happen was the spaceship didn't show. So then you would think that that would be the end of the ball game. Answer is no. That only intensified their belief, and they went off and tried to make converts and say, no, we weren't worthy, we're gonna spread the word and continue to believe that the spaceship is coming sometime in the future. So he looked at, I guess I'm gonna make me crazy what the guy's name was. Yeah, Beseder. So the point is, so he came up with the idea, and again, I can't think of the guy's name at the moment. Leon Festinger, thank you. Leon Festinger, When Prophecy Fails. He said he developed the idea of cognitive dissonance. What does cognitive dissonance mean? Cognitive dissonance means that everybody has an internal reality and an outside reality. We have hopes and we have dreams and stuff like that. Measure the degree of our hopes and our dreams based on what's inside, or what's outside. The outside world is a check on our take on reality. When something like this happens, and there's a total contradiction between our inside reality and our outside reality, generally, if the outside reality contradicts it, we say, okay, it didn't happen, it'll be later, and so you accept the verdict of history and goodbye. There's always a hard core of people who can't do that. For whom the reality of whatever they believe in is so intense that they have to reinterpret the outside world or reinterpret their expectations in order to be able to lower, you can't live in that kind of tension. So you either lower your inside tension and accept the outside, or you reinterpret the outside so that you can live with your inside. Oh, Jews in general. Okay, here you got it on steroids. Okay, here you got it totally on steroids. So, following Festinger's model, that's what happened after Jesus was crucified. Because what happens? Most of the Jews in Jerusalem who hoped he was Messiah, he died. Okay, I'm sorry. They took two Prozac. They had the Pesach. Goodbye. All right. Most Jews in the world went into a deep depression after 1666 because he wasn't the Mashiach. Something similar happened in the United States in 1994, but I won't mention which Hasidic leader led to a similar type of situation. Okay? But phenomenologically, it's the same. By the way, you could say the same thing with regard to Gush Emunim and the peace movement, and the Israeli peace movement. All of them were messianic movements which outside reality contradicted. And the hardcore, and most people gave up, and the hardcore said no. So what do you do? So in the case of Christianity, he's coming back. Okay, in the case of Shabtai Tzvi, he went in to redeem the world from within the world of Tumah. And in the case of this Hasidic leader, he didn't die, he's coming back. If you go into a lot of if you go into a lot of shuls, you'll see in Yiddish, because I figured the average Jew doesn't speak Yiddish anymore, it says, let's be together with the Rebbe in the phenomenal world below Ten Tvachim, because he's above Ten Tvachim. He'll redeem us. So what happens with the Jews after Jesus dies, with those Talmidim, he's gotta be coming back. Now, from a theological point of view, that's dicey, but it's not, doesn't put you out of the camp. Cause, people get resurrected, they come back, Eliyahu didn't die, Hanok didn't die, I mean, you've got, it's, it, I don't know if they'll give you Maftir Yena. I don't know if they'll give you Psichas Nila. I don't know if they're going to not send you to Barbanel, but, or Eitanim, or, you know, whichever. Talbi is no longer in business. You know, but whatever it is, you're not going to, it's not putting you outside of the, right. In fact, you have this famous story, which I tend to believe, that Peter was arrested and brought before the Sanhedrin, and Gamaliel the Pharisee saved his life by saying, look at guys, you know, we'll take a wait and see attitude. If it passes away, or if it works, it doesn't work, why kill the guy? Just, you know, stop. That's one of the reasons why Rabbi Gamaliel this is Gamaliel Azokain, this is Hillel's, grandson, who was living in the time by Cheney, and ostensibly was the teacher also of Paul. That's why he's a Christian saint. If you drive down Kvish, don't go to Kvish Beis HaMishnah, because it's a horror. Until they finish the road, it's going to be, like, terrible. It's the reason why we have such a horror over here, because they're all coming up to Yerushalayim. However, if you take a left at Tzomek Ta'ela, instead of taking a right, you will pass, no, I'm sorry, you can't go. If you go through Beit Shemesh and take a left, you'll see a sign on the left-hand side that says Beit Jamal, with a picture of a church. That is the traditional Christian location of the tomb of Rabbi Gamaliel, upon which is a Greek Orthodox monastery, because he's considered a Christian church, a Christian saint, because he saved Peter at this session of the Sanhedrin. In any case, so these guys, so, you know, like, horrible. Over time, however, the more Jesus doesn't come, and the more intensely you feel it, the more you feel a need to exalt him. And you find inevitably that the object who you want to come back and redeem you ends up becoming greater and greater and greater. Shabtai Tzvi also was deified. In later Sabbatian theology, he becomes part of God. Okay? Similarly, there are the really totally out of the Machane Chabadnikim, who are not called Mashiachistim, but Elohistim. All right? It's not a major part, it's not a central part of the, but the fact that the phenomenon can happen tells you something about the psychological nature of the, of this kind of circumstance. It's not unlike, I think, the situation you had in, after World War II, where a lot of couples got divorced after, the boys came home. One of the reasons being that one of the reasons was, apparently, that the guys idealized, that the image of the loved one left back home was what got them through so many difficult times, but then came home the real bus of Adam that couldn't live up to the ideal, and that, I'm not saying this is the whole story, but this is the theme that does pop up, not infrequently. So that predisposition, now you put that, you know, longing, and that cognitive dissonance together with, now then comes Paul, who says he was God, he was this, he was that. It's a shidduch which actually is not all that strange, not all that hard to understand. Okay. In any event, it's not the whole story, but I think it's a big part of it.
They only had to wait 50 days in there.
Until he came back to appear, but then he went back to heaven. And that's, by the way, that raises, but you also mentioned the question of Jesus' circumcision also raises another issue. Another part of the built-in Jewish problem that Christianity has is the fact that they never quite get away from Pshuto Shel Mikra. In other words, yes, you can interpret everything symbolically as much as you want, but at the end of the day, where's the world peace, and where's the lamb lying down with the wolf, and also with the lion, and all this other stuff? So that that's where the idea of the second coming comes back. It's called parousia in the lingo. Parousia is a Greek word, means second coming. Parousia comes back. A second coming means Jesus has to come back and reveal himself and finish the job and bring world peace. In other words, do the job that the original Jewish Messiah was supposed to do in the place. Because part of the whole business with the redemption of the soul was to, well, he's the Messiah, he died, he was resurrected, but that's not written anywhere, so how are we gonna, what did we miss? So then you go back and you find, develop the entire theory as to how, as to why this stage of Messianic redemption that we didn't know about happened. But in the end, he has to do this as well. So that being the case, Christianity is in a funny position. It's always a religion on condition.
If he comes back.
And therefore you have, and that's, by the way, one of the reasons why millennialism is such a major, I have a friend, Professor Richard Landis, who's made a career out of studying this, how millennialism is a major factor in Christian awareness. The Crusades were a millennial movement. All the excitement about the year 2000 to a significant, you had people jumping off of cliffs when Jesus didn't come back in 2000. And then they say, no, it'll be 2033 because that's 2000 years since the crucifixion. I mean, you got all kinds of variations. Yes?
Did they look for proof in the Torah?
Oh, all over the place.
Right. He should come back?
Correct. Yeah. In fact, that's the other piece of it. We talked about this last week, that in fact, that the New Testament grows out of the Old Testament, has to, therefore you have to anchor everything back. And a lot of the typological parshanut that I started to talk about comes from that effort. Not because you have to prove anything to the Jews, Dafka, but because they have to prove it to themselves. Okay? Because you have to prove it to yourself. And answer the question, how do I find this in here? And therefore, if you want, I forget already who said this. I didn't create this image. If you want, the church fathers and the New Testament are the Torah Shebal Peh of the Christians. They view the Bible through the Tanakh, through the lens, just as we Lahavdil see it through Torah Shebal Peh, Bishum Pishum Kamosh. Okay. Ultimately. I don't remember. Did we talk about the dyads, Sarah and Hagar and Yaakov and Esau? Okay. Christianity is heavily binary anyways. Body and soul, body is bad, soul is good, stuff like that. It's heavily rooted in Hellenistic philosophy where the material is bad and the form is good. If you remember, go back to Plato and Aristotle. And that kind of interpretation runs through classic Christian understandings of the Bible as well. And as part of this attempt to try to wrap their heads around the fact that there's good and there's bad and then there's salvation and there's condemnation, you have a lot of interpretation of the Bible which tries to concretize kind of thing. So, for example, a lot of the pairs in the Bible are seen to prefigure the Jewish-Christian divide, Hebrews and Jews, if you want, the way it was said before. So, for example, it starts already with the Parsha 2 weeks ago. Cain and Abel. Cain is the Isha Adama. He's the earthy guy. He's the earthy, down-to-earth guy, the guy who is full of Yitzarim and so on and so forth. Abel is what? Abel is, he's soft, he's the shepherd of the, he's a friendly shepherd, Jesus is the shepherd always, okay? And the two hate each other, and the offering of Cain was rejected, and the offering of Abel was accepted, so what happens? Cain jumps up and kills Abel, just like the Jew jumps up and kills Jesus. And Abel is in fact the image, he's a prefiguration of Jesus. And if you look at pictures of Cain and Abel as they are painted in Western art, the wood on the altar is always crossed. If you miss the point, there it is. Okay, next pair, Sarah and Hagar. Abraham, of course, is the one who was justified by faith, by Yamein, Bashem, Bashevei, Lot, Tzedakah. He didn't need mitzvahs. Okay? Notice, by the way, the fact that Chazal make a point of saying that Avraham Avinu kept all the mitzvahs in the Torah. One wonders if that's a Christian counter. Okay? It's an interesting possibility. In any event, I'm not saying he didn't, but it certainly served a purpose in that polemic. Okay? But there's Sarah and there's Hagar. Hagar is the Egyptian. She's rejected. She's driven out into the wilderness. And the Sarah, who is the Sarah, she's the princess. She's the noble one. Sarah is the church. She gives birth to Isaac. And Hagar is driven out. That's the Jews. Okay? By the way, that means they're okay. Now, that leads to Isaac. The binding of Isaac is the ultimate prefiguration of the crucifixion, and there always you will find it says by Yarochet Ha'etzim, you'll always find that the wood shows out a And you can see it in cross form. Okay? Then Jacob and Esau, that's the one that really killed the Jews. That's the one that really, killed them. What does it say? Shnei goyim bevitnei chushnei lumimim mimayichi yiparedu ulaom milaom yematz v'rav yavod sa'ir. What does that mean? Rav yavod sa'ir means that the older brother, the Jew, served the younger brother, the Christians. But think for a minute. That means the Jews are who? Esav. Yadecha damim maleu. Ish hadamim. Okay? Who's Jacob? Ish tam yosheva holim. Who's also the real Israel. Okay? Now you have to understand that.
You have to think of Esav as a prefiguration of Rome.
That's us. That's why that was, to have that be said to the Jews was impossible. Because Rome is Rome, and Rome is the church, and Rome is the ultimate source of all, all evil for those of you who ever watched Charmed. And we wish a refuah shleima to Shannon Doherty. She has cancer. Yes, what?
Abraham
becomes he's a Christian.
But Abraham also sacrificed
Yitzchak. Right, at God's... That's true, but that was at God's desire, and God wanted Jesus to be sacrificed up also. Now then the question becomes, that's the classic question, if Jesus is supposed to die, what are you blaming us for? Oh, okay. That's the kasha.
Also, wait, he skipped another pick.
Like the kasha, who? Oh, okay.
Beseder. That's serious business.
That's a very serious business, but it'll take us way beyond where we go. I mean, I'm not as I said, we're water skiing. We're not, or we're skating on this. Okay.
They have our Seder, but now they made it that it's the Lamb of God, which is Jesus.
Right, because he's the Korban Pesach. Okay, so let's start here. I have to fix this because I got promoted since then. Okay, what this ultimately ends up becoming is the contrast between ecclesia et synagoga. And just to give you a sense of how this expresses itself, okay, this is Notre Dame de Paris in the entrance. Every Gothic cathedral in Europe and the entrance has on either side, the statue of two women. One is ecclesia, the church, and one is synagoga. Okay, this is in Notre Dame de Paris, which was finished in the late 13th century. Okay, take a look. This is a synagoga. Oh, you know what? Let me go back a little bit. Here we are. Okay. I'll point out. Let's see if I make life a little easier here. And if you have the sheet from last week, it's there. This is ecclesia. She's a very distinguished woman looking up. She looks down actually those entering into the church. She has a staff, which is a staff of rule. At the top of it is a cross. Her crown sits very beautifully. And she's holding here, she always holds a vessel. That, ladies, is the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail was the cup, according to mythology, that Jesus' blood, which was spilled out for the many, which provides salvation, was collected, and it now is preserved for the salvation of those who come into the precincts of Mother Church. So she has the keys to the kingdom, as it were, the keys to salvation, she has the rule, she has a crown, and she looks down with love upon all who enter. On the other side is synagoga, that's the Jew. Okay? Now, she's a tzibrochen yidna, we would say. Yehudia shvua. If you take a look, first of all, she's holding a spear which is broken in two places. Her crown actually fell down, it's down here. She's holding on, that's the interesting part, to a book. It's the Bible. But the way she's holding on to it is very loose. In other words, this is part of the interesting attitude. We've mentioned about Augustine. The Jew is still the one who's the custodian of the law. He's a living, did we talk about Augustine? We talked about Augustine. Is the living letters of the law, but her hold on it is somewhat, weak. In other words, she has the book, obviously, verstehtnis, was es dorten geschrieben. She doesn't understand what's written in the book. Okay?
She's not grasping it.
She's not really grasping. She's sort of like, very tenuously, correct. Okay? If you take a clip, now, her eyes are closed. Her eyes are blinded. You have to take a close look to see what's going over there. In many other places, we'll see in a second, she's wearing a blindfold. Okay? Why a blindfold? First of all, this is an image of what's called caicatas iudaiorum. the blindness of the Jew. How do you know, why did the Jew not understand that he's supposed to get with the program? The answer is because he's blind. Why is he blind? He either made himself blind by putting us on a blinders, or somebody else made him blind. We'll see in a second. But he knows the truth, but nevertheless, he makes himself blind, doesn't want to admit it. Why? Because the same reason that he killed the prophets and he worshipped the Avodah Zarah and all the bad things in all the Bible that are attributed to the Jew, essentially. There are reasons to think that famous word kike is derived from kaiketas yudeorim and not necessarily from Christ killer, which is the usual etymology which is attributed. This one in Paris is more interesting because there's a snake on her head. The snake from the Garden of Eden, maybe. The snake is also what? The symbol of the devil. And here you have embodied one of the things which Paul already says, you are of your children, the devil, and you inhabit the synagogues of Satan. Because the only way to be able, one of the ways to understand why the Jew is so stubborn is to say, you have an alliance with the other side. And out of that shidduch between Jew and Satan, which ultimately becomes incredibly powerful from the 12th century on, as the image of Satan becomes more elaborated in Western Christian thought, from that come all of the incredible blood libels and the belief that the Jews run the world. I mean, it all comes together. This is another example. This is in the cathedral in Strasbourg. It's the same theme, you can see. She has the Tzibrochen Yidna, which she's looking down. She can't hold on to the book. If you missed it, if the Christian missed it on the way in, you can see it in the windows. This one's not so clear. Now there, by the way, is a key example of Gat Kedat Yitzchak where the wood is carefully arranged. That's enough for right this minute. Okay. There's never able to really come to grips with this idea. Why does a Jew reject? So you develop these sort of inherent qualities. Right. Right. And they're still here. You know, what? That's exactly the question. And even though Augustine provides a theoretical basis, which the Vatican, by the way, never ever really abandoned, okay? Even though Augustine provided the basis for the toleration of the Jew, nevertheless, as Christianity expanded, the frustration became greater. As Christianity conquered the East and went here and went there, hello? How does this work? And you find it popping up in different places. So for number one, the Crusades, ostensibly, were the massacres as the Crusaders went East, argued, why do we have to go schlep all over there to go fight the Muslims? Let's take care of the Jews first. Now, I would say that pops up in the Hebrew Chronicles of the Crusades. And you say, oh, maybe Jew made it up, but we found the exact same argument. They say it's quoted in the Latin Crusader Chronicles as well. In addition, you find it's responsible for, I mean, this kind of thinking is responsible. I'll give you one example. And then we'll go on to the Jewish material. I'll give you one example, and that is the case of the accusation of the desecration of the host. There is a law. It starts in the 13th century. There's this belief that the Jews sneak into churches or hire Christians to steal sanctified wafers so they can torture them. Okay. Now let's wrap. Let's think about this for a minute. From early on. Even from ancient times, do it this way. At the last supper, Jesus tells his disciples, "Here is my body. This is eat this bread. This is my body. Drink this wine. This is the blood of the new covenant, which is spilt out for the many. Oh, do this in remembrance of me." So what the central sacrament, the central moment of all Christian meetings from then on was to recreate the Last Supper and to tell stories about the Master. Okay? Lahav delelef avdolos, it's like a tish. What do you do at a tish? You eat from the Rebbe's food, then you tell the Maisalach and you tell stories and you sing and pray and whatever. It's not a dissimilar kind of dynamic. The I guess it's easy for me to say that because I'm a lit fox. In any event, but very early on, people started to take this idea that this is my body, this is my blood, very, very literally. To the extent that Tertullian, one of the Greek fathers of the church, says that Christians are accused of being cannibals, they eat their God every day. And it became fairly widespread that when the priest raises the wafer and raises the wine, he actually, in a profound, real sense, turns them into blood and the body of Jesus. You can imbibe Jesus, you can be with him, and okay. That's called the doctrine of transubstantiation, that while it looks like it's still a cracker, and it looks like it's still wine, it really is the blood, it really is. Oh, okay. That was a deeply rooted belief in the Catholic Church, especially, but not a dogma. It only became a dogma in 1215. In 1215, at the Fourth Lateran Council, the same one in which Pope Innocent the Third, brought to Europe the Muslim invention, which is called the Jew badge. That was a Muslim invention. We'll see that in a couple of weeks. They also voted, you know, by majority, to make the belief in transubstantiation a dogma. In other words, up until then, overwhelming majority of Christians believed that happened anyways, but now, if you don't, you're not because. You were a heretic. Okay. Within 20 years, Jews are being accused of trying to acquire sanctified wafers. And there are all kinds of miracle stories about how the wafers bleed, about how the wafers scream and ask for help. God appears when the wafers are tortured. All kinds of stories. Now let's think about that for a minute. Okay, what does that mean?
The Jews believe it.
Right. It means the Jews know the truth, but they'll do anything. They'll do anything to hurt the truth because they're diabolical. But more than that, in the 1230s and 1240s, there were still men alive who voted against making transubstantiation a dogma. It means that the Jews know better than the cardinals and the bishops who voted no. I mean, that's incredible. Okay? The famous blood libel is a similar kind of thing. It's the flip side. The original blood libel was that just Jews hate Christians and they'll kill them under any circumstance. Goodbye. That was the whole deal. Okay? The later version is the one we know about putting blood in the matzahs. What does that mean? What does it mean putting blood in matzahs? And Christian blood? And Christian children blood. What does that mean? It means that the Jew wants salvation, but he hates salvation. But he'll get the salvation of the blood of Jesus in some kind of perverted way by taking a sinless child, putting his blood into the matzah, because that's the wafer, it is unleavened bread, and then eating it. You're projecting on the Jew the idea that he's sort of like the inverse, or obverse, I don't know, whatever you, he's the negative of the positive. But it all because that's really diabolic. Okay? So yes, it says a lot about mass psychology, child psychology, and mob psychology and stuff like that, but it all grows out organically out of high cultural identifications between Jew and devil as another way of trying to understand why the Jew didn't get with the program. And of this typological explanation of the Bible, where there's the good guys and the bad guys, and you draw the picture of the Jew only with blacks, with shades of black or gray. Is that right? Now that does that mean the Jews and Christians were always at each other's throats? Does that mean no? But this is part of this collective perception of the Jew, which grows out of. Almost organically, yes, organically, out of these ideas. Ironically, when the Jews were put into ghettos, and by the way, I'm not going to go into the fact that Jews were blamed for all of the heresies which rooted Europe. Ultimately, they thought that, sort of strange. One of the reasons they put Jews into ghettos in the 16th century is because of the Protestant Reformation and this idea somehow that Jews were responsible for Luther. Of course, Luther was the founder of modern anti-Semitism, which is sort of like, you know, you know, as Sancho Panza says in Man of La Mancha, whether the pitcher hits the stone or the stone hits the pitcher, it's always bad for the pitcher. So, in this case, that's how it works. When the Jews were put into ghetto and, the daily contact with Jews was minimized in most parts of Europe, and Germany was a little bit different, the European imagination goes wild, and all of these sort of images of Jews become more exact. It's impossible to believe they could be more exacerbated, but the image of the Jew as Satan sort of became even more developed. So that when the emancipation came and Jews were let out of the ghettos, it was with this sort of, you know, subtext that was always there. Should we give them rights? Not give them rights? They're this, they're that, they're the other thing. And ultimately, I'm not saying that the church is responsible for the Nazis, but it's very clear that racial anti-Semitism drew very heavily on images and ideas that were rooted in this sort of way of trying to figure out, like, how come this is how things played themselves out. It's not a happy story. Again, it doesn't mean that there wasn't cooperation, it doesn't mean that there weren't correct relations, but one thing I can tell you, there was never any kind of convivencia. Up until modern time, there was no convivencia, living together and happy and whatever, as much some historians might want to say otherwise. Okay, so that's the broad sort of like image in terms of, broad story in terms of, the right attitude toward, the classical attitude toward Judaism. How that plays itself, you know what, maybe we'll do this next week, but how that plays itself out in terms of contemporary theology, so maybe that's what I should close with here. It varies. You have evangelicals who reinterpret the Bible directly and do it without this Christian add-on. How they manage to do that, that's their problem, but the Jews should be back in Israel and so on and so forth. So that does happen. One of my students started yelling at me once in class, but they think that if we all come to Jesus, he'll come back. And then I said, you know what? When Jesus comes back, I'll worry about it. In the meantime, they're helpful. So I'm like, I'm not so worried about Jesus coming back that it's gonna affect my whatever. That's number one. Number two, so that's one line. There is serious to think that opposition to the Christian theological opposition to the state of Israel is ultimately, not totally, but ultimately rooted in this doctrine of Christian supersessionism and Jewish rejection. It's certainly true in terms of the Catholic Church. Catholic Church, we know moans about the fact that, for, among others, there's a pasuk in the Bracha of Yaakov Avinu, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, mechokek mi ben raglav, ad ki yavo Shiloh. Shiloh is the most, actually, truth is that there's a Midrashic tradition also identifies Shiloh with the Messiah, but in other words, once the Messiah comes, Jews will no longer have any sovereignty, any dominion. After the Holocaust, after the Shoah, it was no longer plausible. It wasn't nice to sit there and say that about the Jews and oppose Zionism on those grounds. So that then at that point the papal policy became, no, once there's peace, once there's negotiations between the Palestinians, we have to be even handed. Okay. So in 1993, after the Oslo Accords, the Israeli government said to the Pope, okay, put your money where your mouth is. And indeed, John Paul II sent right-hand theological guy, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who then became Pope Benedict XVI, who was at the time the head of what was the heir to the Inquisition, the Congregation of the Sanctity of the Faith, to negotiate with the Israelis, and the following happened. The Vatican established diplomatic relations with the State of Israel. After the papal legate, who was the principal representative of the Vatican in Jerusalem anyways, for all the years, gave a letter of accreditation to President Weizmann at the time. He called a press conference and said, the Holy See has today established relations with the State of Israel, which has no religious, cultural, historical significance, something like that. It's like having relations with Madagascar or whatever. And at that point, he moved his office from Yerushalayim to Tel Aviv. Okay? So basically the idea was that you can be, or the other way around, however you want to, how to darshan it. They sort of squared the circle. And I asked a number of people, is that what they were trying to do? Yes, they wanted to have, they had to fess up, but they didn't want to change their theological position. And that was the theological position, that Israel has no theological significance whatsoever, and therefore they don't have to chuck out a bunch of psukim from the way, or at least their interpretation of certain psukim. And that's where things stood. And that's the reason, by the way, and it was pathetic, actually, that the that when the Pope came, the Pope's been here twice, both Popes have been here, all three have been here, actually, that there's always somebody saying, well, take responsibility for the Holocaust, or do this, or do that, or recognize this as a Jewish state, and so on. You can't ask that of a person who have a different belief system. I mean, it's not fair. You want me to throw up Baba Kama because you don't like it? I mean, no. I mean, that's the way it works. I can't help that. This, who, by the way, is not, with whom the conservative elements in the Catholic Church are not happy, I know for a fact, this Pope actually said a few things which are very, very striking. And I'm trying to figure out exactly what it means. He has said that anybody who says that the state of Israel cannot be the state of the Jewish people as their expression of self-definition is an anti-Semite. Now that's a very, very far-reaching statement, I think. Talk to other people who were also involved in the issue, and they were less sanguine, less excited about the statement. They think that maybe it's what he's also sort of like blowing smoke because so it's one thing to say something on Twitter, it's another thing to say it, you know, ex cathedra as the Pope, which creates Catholic dogma, but they are unparalleled statements. There is no doubt, in my mind, that the opposition of liberal Protestant churches to so-called government policy derives, if not emotionally, certainly in terms of, and not in terms of some of its content, but certainly emotionally, from this undercurrent of hostility which is built into the system. Now, then you'll ask, what are all the anti-Semitic images doing in Muslim, in our propaganda? That we'll get to in 3 weeks. But okay, so please bring these. We will need these. Because what we're going to do is we're going to shift over and talk about what was the Jewish response, what's the Jewish status, what's the status of Christianity, excuse me, according to Halacha. Then in the last two sessions, maybe already next week, we'll talk about Islam, and answer the question I just asked. Yeah.